I'm JD.
And I'm Fraser, and this is episode 5 of the 150 Marches.
Homosexual behaviour between adult consenting males in private should no longer be a criminal offence.
This march was the catalyst for all the rights we've got now.
Why don't we know who they are?
In the vote on gay marriage. Gay marriage.
The eyes have it. The eyes have it.
Children need to be taught.
Charlie Craig's with us today.
Children need to be taught.
Our interview with Peter Tatchell.
Children need to be taught that they have an inalienable right to be gay.
Blackout UK.
Liam Hackett.
Phil Samba from Prepster. The brave step back then.
And we want to make sure that people know their names. Know their names. Know their names. So how are you doing, JD?
I'm good. So much has happened, right? 2020 is finally over.
It's over and we made it. We are back in lockdown.
Yes, we are. But we are still here, which is great. And we launched the first 4 episodes of the podcast.
We did, which was amazing. So thank you to everyone who's listened, subscribed, messaged us. It's been really wonderful to see how our little journey is capturing so many hearts and minds. So thank you.
Someone's still full of some holiday cheer.
It is amazing, though. It's really cool. And hope you're looking forward to everything we have in store for you in 2021. Also, we wanted to say a big thank you to people who supported us online, from people like Sir Ian McKellen, Adam Brown, David Paisley, Freema Adjiman, to name but a few. That has been a real boost to our listening figures, so thank you.
Yeah, and it's also been really quite awesome to read the wonderful reviews and to hear from people who know other people and want to talk with us. Just as a reminder, we are on Twitter and Instagram. Our handle on both is 150marchers. The DMs are open, so slide right in.
Now, as you'll remember, we finished the last episode by reading off a list of 25 names, some confirmed, some yet to be, who we believe were at the first LGBTQ+ march on November the 27th, 1970 at Highbury Fields. And like we said then, we were going to go away and research these names and bring back our findings in the new year, which is what we've done. So we're going to share what we've discovered, and also, like we promised, each episode we're going to share an interview with a current campaigner working for the LGBTQ+ community.
Today's interview is with Dan Glass, who, as you might remember from the last episode from last year, is not only an activist and campaigner, but along with Stuart Feather, reformed the GLF. He's also written a book called United Queerdom, which is available at Gays the Word. Dan's interview will be coming up shortly. But before that, let's share what we've learned about some of the people on our list of 25 marchers.
One thing we did do is we left a name off our last list.
We did that on purpose to see if anyone would notice.
Did they?
No, they did not.
Moving on. So the person we left off was Martin Grant.
And if you've been following along, Martin Grant was friends with Philip Roscorla, who we spoke with in episode 4, and they went to the march together.
That's right. And Philip said that Martin passed away in the 80s during the AIDS pandemic.
And as Martin was a photographer, he had taken a lot of pictures and a lot of video.
But unfortunately, they were destroyed after he died by his parents, who didn't accept his homosexuality.
That's right. It's incredibly sad.
We've reached back out to Philip to speak with him about Martin, so we can know a little bit more about who he was.
Another name which we mentioned at the end of last episode, and someone who was confirmed through the photographs from the Times, was Mick Belston.
Yes, Andrew confirmed that Mick was in the photos when we showed them him, and he also informed us that Mick had passed away during the AIDS pandemic as well.
Right, so I went back to my copy of Blowing the Lid by Stuart Feather, which is highlighted so much right now, it's basically neon, to see what I could find out, or where Mick was mentioned throughout.
And I checked through the Geoffrey Weeks book coming out to find that Mick wasn't mentioned there.
But there was quite a bit about him in Stuart's book. He seemed to be quite involved in the beginnings, and then also in writing numerous articles for the various publications GLF were responsible for. In terms of his character, I did find a quote about him by Sarah Grimes, read here by Debbie Perry.
Mick Belston was particularly warm. It wasn't until I read his obituaries that I realised his background, with the Merchant Navy and everything. So he was a bit older than most of us. Most of us in the media workshop were in their early 20s. We would meet in his flat in Barnes. It was a lovely place. I don't think he did an awful lot of the writing, but he was a great facilitator. He could put people at their ease and get discussion going. He had a great kindness. He never got overwrought, so he could sort out things with printers and so on.
He's also quoted as being one of the GLF members who attended the Travers trials.
Now, that's the Travers Theatre, Edinburgh, right?
Correct. The abbreviated version of what the Travers trials were is this. Basically, they were organised by the theatre director, Michael Rudman, who would host them. These debates were held on a Sunday night after a performance on topical issues. Members of the GLF went up to Edinburgh and watched the play Staircase by Charles Dyer.
Now, I know that play.
You do?
Yep. It's about an older gay couple who own a hairdresser's, or it's a barbershop, I think, one of the two. And one of them is about to stand trial for propositioning a policeman.
A pretty policeman. Oh, they're everywhere.
A pretty policeman, not an ugly one.
So the Travers Theatre Club did this play Staircase in 1971, and off the GLF members went to attend the Travers trial. They watched the play, then afterwards, they had a trial on an issue. So they have people who are there for and against, and then they'd open it up to the floor. The one the GLF members attended was all discrimination against homosexuals by law, by employers, and by society at large should end.
Wow, I wonder whose side they're on.
Sassy.
And this is in 1971.
Yes. One of the comments made by the GLF came from Mick Belston, and this is what he said, read here by Michael Dillon.
Look, I'm the eldest of 9 children. I've had babies, plenty of babies. I don't want any more. I don't want any babies. I've a brother who's gay and a sister who's gay, and we're all very happy. And we don't want kids. We're not missing out on a thing.
I mean, that is pretty amazing. Standing up in public and saying things like that. I mean, I know it's in a theatre and it's generally assumed that, you know, an audience is more liberally tolerant, but it's still a really bold thing to do.
I think it's awesome. And the final thing, which I thought was really wonderful, is an article he wrote in Come Together 8 regarding the Oz trial.
Remind me, what was the Oz trial?
Oz was one of several underground publications in the 1970s that gave pioneering coverage to contentious issues such as censorship, homosexuality, and police brutality. They were targeted by the Obscene Publication Squad, and a controversial trial resulted in several prison sentences for its editors and contributors. The article is titled About Oz, About GLF, About Freedom, and is read by Flynn McManus.
A great deal of heated discussion has taken place recently within GLF as to whether or not we should support the Oz trio in the recent prosecution. The objections, which were many and strongly held, sprang from what many of us thought was the blatant sexism in Oz magazine's treatment of women, and also gay people, as sex objects, subject to male superiority, inferior tools of male pleasure, objects of ridicule. Others in GLF either could not see the sexism in Oz, or felt that if it was sexism, it was something which GLF should deal with at a later date. GLF support for Oz had already been published, which rankled many sisters and brothers, who felt that such decisions should not be made without discussion. Hopefully we learn from such mistakes, and will fully discuss all such issues and declarations before making public statements in future. At any rate, no decision, fait a comply or not, was in fact arrived at, though the general feeling was probably sympathetic to Oz. This sympathy, it must be stressed, came principally from the men in GLF, not generally from the women who were the most critical. Supporters of Oz had stressed that what was happening to Oz could and would happen to us. That this was a first freedom which was being attacked, and that we were as much of the victims as Jim, Richard and Felix. Their view was that Oz needed all the friends and supporters who could be mustered. In the event, the sentences were announced, and the reverberations of shock hit GLF immediately. It seemed to come together in its true proportions. We did feel attacked, we did feel victimized, and our intelligence was insulted by the brutal, sadistic, bigoted, and repressive sentences. We were angry. We already find ourselves in GLF being censored. The workshop which produces this magazine has had to make a decision. We received an article written by a GLF member which, for its deliberately ambiguous approach to a vital subject of interest to all gay brothers, for its high literary quality and its controversial nature, we all felt strongly should be published. But although we admired it and wished to print it, we knew that it undoubtedly would be provocation to the enforcers of the so-called obscenity laws. Had we the right, as a group within GLF, to put at risk the whole organisation, with the expenses involved, the possible imprisonment of gay activists, and the loss of a whole edition of Come Together? We discussed this problem in great and sometimes agonising depth. The possibility of having it approved or not by the coordinating committee of GLF or even a members' meeting would not be possible for such a piece of writing, and we decided to shelve the problem. Angrily and bitterly, we decided not to include it in this issue. We became our own censors. The Austral pigeons came home to roost. What shall we do, brothers and sisters? What shall we do?
I kind of wish he was still around.
I do as well, because it would have been great to talk to him and, of course, all of the others who are no longer with us.
But he is on our list. Mick Belston.
We thank you and honour you.
Next, we're going to share with you what happened to Warren Haig. Because if you remember, Warren Haig was a straight gay who was reading the GLF demands in the photos from the Times, and we discovered his name was spelt two different ways.
There's a lot of information and I'm still looking into it as to like what is relevant and what isn't. However, we did get in touch with Jeffrey Weeks.
We did. Jeffrey wrote the book we referenced earlier called Coming Out. And he was at the march, as told to us by a couple of guys we've already spoken to.
When we talk to him, we should ask him, as he may be able to help.
So we'll be bringing you our interview with Jeffrey in a few weeks. We've been told that his presence at the 1970 march had a profound effect on his personal life. So we're really excited to find out from him what that was. Now, something else pretty major happened while we were on a break.
The government cancelled Christmas.
Yeah, but not that.
Trump lost the election like 3 times.
Yeah, but not that.
Domestic terrorists took over the Capitol building.
Also, yes, but not that.
If it was none of those things, then what, Fraser? What?
The 50th anniversary of the Highbury Fields March.
Oh, yeah!
Now, the original plan was for myself and JD to attend.
That is right.
And you even took some holiday off your job, didn't you?
I did, but then because of the ever-changing minds of the idiots in charge, it didn't seem like a good idea to go down to London, and we decided to launch the podcast instead.
Which we did. However, the original plan by the reformed GLF was to commemorate the march on the 27th, but then it was pushed back a week.
Yes, it was. So I'm glad I didn't go, as I would have just been standing there at Highbury Fields in the cold, like a plum.
Like a plum.
And so the event which was organised changed a bit, and it was smaller. A week later, the original marchers and some new GLF members went along.
Which leads us very nicely into our first interview of the year, Mr. Dan Glass.
He fills us in on not only his own LGBTQ+ activism, but how the new GLF commemorated the 50th anniversary in 2020.
I'm from East London, I still live here, I love this place to pieces, and I'm an activist with the Gay Liberation Front. I wrote a book about my time with them, which is United Queerdom, From the Legends of the Gay Liberation Front to the Queers of Tomorrow, which also is, for me, very much a revenge book, because I'm a Section 28 baby. Section 28 being the criminalisation of homosexuality in public institutions from 1988 to 2003, which was the exact time that I started school and finished college. You know, the culture of silence pre-partial decriminalisation in 1967, there was parallels with Section 28, because it's so dehumanising, you internalise that stigma.
Could you tell us what the catalyst was to you reforming the GLF?
I was standing in the smoker's corner of the Joiners Arms, which was an amazing venue in Hackney, We were all very aware of the mass closure of queer spaces. At the time, it was a third of queer spaces had been shut in the last 5 years. Now it's worse because of Corona. And then we found out about our beloved Joiners being going to be shut down. And so, we started a campaign against that, the closure of that. But we also wanted to do something deeper rather than just firefighting. So that's where the idea of Queer Tours of London and Mince Through Time came from, about how do we really deepen our understanding of the streets, of the community that we inhabit, about the queer power which we've been denied, whether that's around queer spaces, queer clubs, or relationships, or revolutionary movements, or street battles. So really, that's where it was born. And so for the last 4 or 5 years, we've done, with some of the activists from the Gay Liberation Front, all kinds of queer tours of London, in Hackney, in Wapping, in Soho, in Brixton, with lots of different groups as well, like the Rebel Dykes, the punk leather lesbians from the 80s, or the Gay Liberation Front, or the African Rainbow Family, the LGBT migrant movement, and continuing the struggle for absolute freedom for all, which the Gay Liberation Front's mantra was and still is, seeing all injustices as connected. But when we were talking about the idea of Queer Tours of London to be really empowered by our history and how it can take us forward, I was like, okay, I need to do some research. And then went to Gaze the Word Bookshop, and Uli, who's one of the amazing organisers, managers at Gaze the Word Bookshop, said, Dan, you've got to read Blowing the Lid by Stuart Feather, which is a brilliant account of the Gay Liberation Front. And I was completely blown away and inspired by radical, fierce, hilarious, effective, recent gay liberation movements, particularly the Gay Liberation Front. And then I've always been a big fan of, like, if you don't ask, you don't get. So I emailed Stuart and was like, can we meet up? Can we meet up? You're fucking amazing. And the journey of Gay Liberation Front, of the aim, absolute freedom for all, obviously hasn't been met yet in this political climate. And so it's about, actually, how can we do justice to the legends like Stuart, who started Gay Liberation Front and continue their journey for absolute freedom for all? And, you know, finding out about the radical roots of the Gay Liberation Front, being born out of the Black Power and Women's Liberation Movement, particularly the Philadelphia Revolutionary Convention. And so met up with Stuart, and is such an incredible spirit who's still full of fierceness and full of criticality and full of vision. And then we started the GLF Thinkings, very much in the same format as they did 50 years ago, in the same place at LSE, to continue the discussions around absolute freedom for all. And particularly a lot of the energy at that time, when we restarted it in 2017, was about challenging pride in London Corporation and how they've co-opted and done a disservice to what Pride in London originally was all about. So finding out about the GLF is such a joy, because they're so sharp, they're so visionary, and they're so committed to humanity for all.
How did you start recruiting a new generation to the GLF?
I mean, at the time, I was, and I still am, very involved in ACT UP, AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power. So some of the movements behind the scenes, there was AIDS Coalition to Unleash Power, Queer Tours of London, Friends of the Joiners' Arms, and Stuart and me got involved together as part of ACT UP. And then Stuart brought his friends from the original Gay Liberation Front, and I brought some of the younger generation who were keen to get involved, and it's slowly built from there. And now we've got like 700 people on the social media group and 100 on the key organizers group. And we met every month since then until the pandemic, and a lot of energies. At the end of 2016, we held an event called Look Back in Pride, where Stuart spoke along with other activists who were living in the legacy and acting in the legacy of fighting for absolute freedom for all. Then in 2018, particularly, we had a specific project called Sexual Avengers, which was on the 30th anniversary of the beginning of Section 28, to platform the damage done by Section 28 and call for compensation, call for reparations, call for queer history being told on every street corner. And one of the key actions at the beginning, which got a lot of attention, was with pink filing cabinets. We made 15 pink filing cabinets out of cardboard boxes, and Stuart's was beautiful. He's also an incredible artist, painter as well. And they said, where is our permanent home? We need a queer museum. because in Britain, there's no permanent queer museum, no permanent queer art space, no comprehensive LGBT housing program. And much of the infrastructure that we need for our community intergenerationally to be able to meet our fundamental human needs. And that's a legacy of Section 28, and very telling that there's a lot of talk and not enough action in the form of infrastructure that actually meet the needs of our community. And so ever since 2016, when we restarted the GLF Thinkings, it's just grown and grown. And so many relationships and different projects have blossomed out of that. Because one of the most amazing things about Gay Liberation Front's methodology is wit, is satire, is self-deprecation, is humour, is pathos as a survival tool. You've got to laugh or cry, and institutional homophobia in all of its forms has been so damaging that the wit and the kind of the creativity of the Gay Liberation Front is so inspiring as an effective tool of resistance to homophobia. So it's also a lot of fun.
Tell us more about queer tours and the types of people who come on them.
So the three formats of queer tours is walking tours, like Soho, Hackney, Brixton. If you live out of those areas and you live in Ealing or whatever, and you want a tour to be curated there, then get in touch. That's the research we do. And actually, that's part of one of my favourite, when we get requests to do new places, because one of the kind of cheesy mantras we say is that every street, every building in Britain has a queer history. It's just because of institutional homophobia, we've been denied it. And it's fascinating when you find out what happens in new areas. Then we have the kind of special events, which is like the Bank Bus that we did, where we did a tour of London on a bus. The first thing we did was queer spaces, where we had five different stops, one per decade since partial decriminalisation, with people who were in the clubs at the time, talking about what it was like. It was called Club Bang after Stuart and a lot of the other GLFers' favourite club Bang in Tottenham Court Road. We then did one around HIV and AIDS with nurses and doctors who have been fighting the fight throughout the decades, who were speaking on the bus. It was really powerful. And then special themed tours, whether it's around trans rights or global LGBT rights, where we visit different embassies, for example. And in your question about who comes on them, whole range of different people, of course, not just LGBT, but people from all around the world. And that's really interesting as well. Like, I remember one of the beginning tours, we had a whole group of Ugandan queer people. And afterwards they said to me, they were like, so can you take us to your LGBT community center? And I was like, we don't have one. And they're like, what? We live in a country where there's literally a bill called Kill the Gays Bill, and we've got an LGBT community center and you don't have one. And for me, it really said a lot, because we can talk a lot about the need for queer power, but we don't have the infrastructure to truly do justice to it. Now we do, since that conversation, we do have an LGBT homeless centre. There's now two LGBT elderly people's homes in Britain, not one in London. You've got in Brighton and in Manchester. We don't have a full-time LGBT museum, an LGBT art centre, a comprehensive LGBT housing programme. So it says a lot about the state of Britain and how we can exist within it or not, as the case may be. So that's the kind of framing. And I feel so lucky. It's the best job ever, because you just get to meet incredible people, whether they're doing the tour where we collaborate with them as guest speakers or people from around the world. And obviously, and then we also get, like, I remember a conversation which stuck in my head was a boy and his mum came. He was a young guy, I don't know, about 20. And his mum just burst into tears at the end. She was like, I never realised, you know, the gravity of your community, of what you've been through, of the shoulders of people that you're standing on. And so you do get really beautiful conversations like that as well.
What are the biggest obstacles you face in your work?
Prejudice and stigma and complacency of inaccessible venues and spaces. If we're living in the principle of GLF, which is absolute freedom for all, then we've got to make things accessible. Walking tours in themselves aren't that accessible, and that's why we did the bus tours. I can hardly do events in many places in London, because there's not one fully accessible space, LGBT space, in central London, and there's barely any elsewhere. And I refuse to organise events in spaces which aren't accessible, because we've got tour guides in wheelchairs. So a very practical obstacle has been accessibility. It's difficult slash the most rewarding thing. Often that's the most difficult things are, right? Is the emotional navigation of it all. It's the trauma. And trauma, really, not just in GLF, but in all of my activism, is really at the heart of what I do in terms of trauma and transformation. The levels of trauma are so huge, not just for the older generation, for the younger generation as well, which we, you know, we're products of centuries of compounded homophobic persecution. The original GLF members have seen their friends and their lovers, you know, kill themselves, be killed, die throughout the AIDS genocide. And then the younger generation today, we're still living with such trauma because of the lack of protections that we have, because of the denial of our rights, because of Section 28, because of stigma still associated with sexual freedom. And it's, you know, we just crack on because we need to, right? Because there's a struggle to be done and we've got work to do, but we can't, it's on a epidemiological level and on a trauma level, you can't brush it off. It goes inside, and that's the work of trauma that and activism and art and healing, that you have to externalize it. It's better out than in, because otherwise you internalize it and it damages you inside. And I think on so many different levels, we've never had the opportunity to talk about who we are publicly, you know, because of public homophobic persecution and LGBT hate crime. Barely had time or capacity to actually speak from the heart in behind closed doors. So we're not used to healing ourselves, and the trauma is really vivid. Not in a way that, like, we don't, you know, we're not sitting around talking about our feelings and crying. I mean, we probably should be doing that. But I think in terms of the trauma, it's the ability, and I do this myself, in terms of loving ourselves. And whether that's self-care, whether that's celebrating ourselves, because we constantly just continue the fight because there's so much to do. You know, there's specific examples might be how so many, and this fucking breaks my heart, like the older generation of GLF, you know, their partners who are in old people's home who were receiving massive homophobia. A lot of homophobia goes on in old people's homes. And the fact that these legends who started the modern pride movement then have to go back into the closet in their old age and their dying days is a fucking crime. And it's just so brutal to witness that we have to, you know, we can never truly inhabit our identities because we're always fighting, and B, we've never been allowed to be our full, you know, it's called self-actualization. We've never been able to be our full human selves because we've had to narrow ourselves within the culture of domination.
What do you think makes a good activist?
Well, this is a great question, because I think activism is obviously a very loaded, a very controversial, stigmatized word. And I think every human is an activist. It just depends what they're activating on. If you're really just looking at the basic structure of what the word activism is, it's activating. You could be activating in the far right, you're still an activist. You could be activating in support to build your loving family. So you're being an activist. Of course, it's just been reduced. It's so reductive when it's, you know, obviously in Britain, activists are seen as just like freeloading hippies who just want to cause trouble. You know, it's a dirty word. Whereas if in other communities, activism, when you say you're an activist, they're like, I get what you do. I support what you do. If you need anything, because you commit your life to the greater common good. And so in Britain, because of Thatcher and the rest of it, it's a very dirty word. And therefore, we've got to zoom out and cherish the importance of proactivity and standing on our own two feet, whatever the kind of framework we're within. But does it take a specific person to be an activist for social change, for the greater common good? I know what's helped me. I can't speak for everyone, because that's the beauty of activism, in terms of you meet lots of incredible people who dedicate their lives in so many different ways for so many different reasons. Just like, you know, anyone could be a baker, like anyone can be an activist. And so everyone's got their own specific ways of getting involved. For me, the thing that stuck in my head as a kid, my grandparents were Holocaust survivors. My nan used to tell me her story of survival on repeat. War survivors often come out to their grandkids before they do their kids, because they try and protect their kids. And when they're old, they release it all. So I actually heard her stories of, you know, she saw the Warsaw ghetto burn down and what that was like. And, you know, the mantra of never again, ever, and stuck in my head. And if you've got the privilege to be able to exist without fear of getting killed, then you should do what you can to support other people who are affected by injustice. And it's always been really acute for me that if it wasn't for the underground resistance movement who saved my nan and my other grandparents' lives, I mean, they literally did, whether they're in the Warsaw ghetto or bringing them food when my other nan was in hiding, and I wouldn't be here. So, you know, the Holocaust isn't happening now, but the infrastructure that enables it still exists, whether that's the arms trade, whether that's institutional homophobia, whether that's capitalism, you know, it still exists. And therefore, it could happen again. And it is happening again if we're looking in Chechnya, for example. So if we're looking at LGBT free zones in Poland, like the infrastructure of mass bigotry, which could easily spiral into gas chambers, still exists.
What do you think makes a good ally?
I want to give an example first, because I also think about allyship a lot. I think there's a lot of bullshit in movements, in general political conversations about who can be an ally and who can't. And if you're not this, then you can't be an ally. So boring and exhausting. One of the most ridiculous things I ever heard was actually at Glasgow Pride when I was there, I don't know, like 5-6 years ago or something, an HIV block was planning to go together. And this one guy started on this other guy, and he stood up and he was like, "You've got no right to be here because you've got HIV negative privilege." And I was like, "What?" I was like, "Listen to yourself. The whole point of being an HIV activist is that we don't want people to get HIV. Fucking get out." So there's a lot of, you know, we're doing the oppressors' work for them by like tearing each other down. The fight for gay men's health during the HIV pandemic would never have been won if it wasn't for a lesbian allyship. It's just one example, and we need to challenge the hierarchy of how history's told or how herstory's told. I think the best ally is responding to the struggle, to the issues, in the way that the people who are on the front line need, in the whole kind of mantra of nothing about us without us is for us. The people who are facing the oppression have to lead the struggle and say what they need. Then 90% of the efficacy of social transformation comes from the relational work. It's not the high publicized demonstrations. It's not like the big scale protests and films and blah, blah. It's the everyday emotional labor behind the scenes, which is, do you want a cup of tea? Or can I come to the doctors with you? Which is so important because it's fucking difficult. As well as joyous and celebrating, it is hard work committing yourself to like the daily grind of trauma and activism. So just being there as a fucking good pal is really important. And being like, okay, you need to stop, come out to the pub. Or if you don't drink, come and do something else.
Activism takes a lot of energy and emotional commitment. So how do you take care of yourself?
How do I take care of myself? I'm actually better these days than I was. I live just by the Thames. I go running a lot, I go swimming a lot. Not in the Thames, at the swimming pool. Well, I recognise, you know, one thing that was a real kind of line in the sand for me was getting HIV 15 years ago. And before I got a medication, I really noticed when I wasn't looking after myself, I got like pretty instant body consequences. And it became very clear to me that, you know, obviously HIV being a stress-related condition, and that if I get stressed, then I get sick. And so I actively tried to live a stress-free life. And of course, like 99.9% of people would look at my life and be like, "That's stressful." But actually, behind the scenes, I've worked out a way to, you know, we need to be activists for the rest of our lives. And so therefore, we need to make it enjoyable. And that's not trivializing the serious issues. But art and creativity and self-care and reading and shagging and partying, and it's fun. It's also really serious. And that's the cheesy quote of the trauma into treasure. How you work with really deep wounds of dehumanization to turn them into real gold.
If you could tell your teenage self anything, what would you say?
Basically, I'd locked everything off in my head because up until the age of 15, because it was crap, put it away. And my twin sister's always been like, "Do you remember this as a kid?" I'm like, "I don't know what you're talking about. I don't know what you're talking about." She gets really upset. But I hadn't obviously forgotten it. It's just I'd put it so deep in my head because I grew up in a religious family as well, you know, in Section 28. And so I had to then say to her, "What actually happened?" And she was like, "Oh, so now you want to know." And it was, you know, whether it was like just lots of interactions with the police, like being out, getting really drunk, running away a lot, really, in hindsight, probably really dangerous sexual encounters and leaving home. And then I remember getting kicked out of a gay refuge when I was like 14 and ran away to a gay refuge. And then in London, and then ended up getting kicked out because I ended up sleeping with this guy. And the manager said, he was like, "You're not allowed to do that." And in my head, I was like, "What? This is a gay refuge. I've just come from a really fundamentalist religious home, and I'm not." And then they kicked me out, and then we're sitting at the bus stop in the middle of the night in fucking Hendon, which is, makes you suicidal in itself. And it was just like, oh, that shit. So I think what I would say to my inner child would be just carry on. Carry on. Carry on. don't kill yourself.
And what do you think that your teenage self would say back to you?
Probably either wouldn't believe me or would just be like, shut up, where's the drugs? You know, places like Trade and Ghetto were fucking lifelines for me. You know, me and my mates from synagogue, we literally called it running from the synagogue to Soho. I knew four kids who by the age of 14 had killed themselves. And so the rest of us fled. And then you build your queer family and then you don't have to go back to synagogue. Not that all synagogue's bad. It's just I grew up in an Orthodox synagogue. It wasn't until a lot later that I found, I didn't realise you could have a lesbian rabbi. I didn't realise that not all Jewish religious doctrines wanted to kill you, see you as an abomination. You know, a lot of people have said, have you seen that Netflix thing, Unorthodox? And I'm like, I don't need to, because I know what that was like.
What do you think of our attempts to collate the names of the original marchers?
I'm so excited for you. You're going to be in for such a roller coaster of beautiful things and of really sad things as well. I think the work that you're doing is really important, so important, if we're looking at, you know, reclaiming our stolen heritage. And this is such a milestone. It's the first LGBT protest in Britain. It's huge. And I think, and it's life affirming. It's reclamation. It's a process of reparations as well, in terms of, so it's super powerful. There'll be a lot of trauma that comes up. I mean, this is, again, is what happens on the queer tours in terms of, it's not just like a mince through the streets or on the buses. There's some big shit which comes up as well. It's quite funny because every time you bring back different generations of queer culture, you're also bringing back their beef as well. Or the Rebel Dykes one in Brixton, it's called Bricks and Dykes on the Rampage. Like 30 hardcore like punk lesbians from back in the 80s came up and one was like, oi, I remember you, you fucking shagged my girlfriend. And I'm like, oh shit, what's going on? Or like, you've still got the like the sassiness and the diva-ness of a lot of the GLF, because people have had to fight their whole lives. So of course they're going to be fucking queens. So you're also going to be bringing back a lot of wounds. You know, Peter, of course, probably half of them in the 150 died in the AIDS genocide. There'll be lots of like, how do we continue the struggle, which is doing justice to those 150 people.
Could you tell us about the 50th anniversary meetup the GLF held at Highbury Fields at the end of last year?
It was short and sharp and sweet and incredible. It was one of the most surreal and magical actions I've ever lucky to be part of. It was really powerful, but it was only like 45 minutes because of the circumstances. So many people, much more people than I thought. It was really cold as well. We asked people to turn up really sharp. I stayed at the station and directed everyone whilst everyone else went and set up. And it was amazing. It was wearing a really loud leopard print jacket so that people would see me. And there were so many more people than I thought. And, you know, we had to keep things off social media, really. And it was just a nice reminder that things work without social media. And when, you know, almost we have to go back to that style of zap kind of actions now. And then we had the giant cigarettes as well, which were like both obviously symbolic in relation to the cruising aspect where Louis was smoking outside the toilet, but also was a really useful tool for distancing. Then we had speeches, little quiz where we threw out some of the GLF masks that we got made. And then we got the sparklers and went down to the plaque, and there were some beautiful images from there. And it was just really, it was really moving, both for the people who were there 50 years ago and the older generation and for the younger generation. So it was really moving in terms of on an informative level and on an emotional level. Also, it was really just heartwarming for people to get together, particularly after such a, you know, obviously the ongoing changes with the pandemic. And I think, you know, I don't want to talk too much about the pandemic, but people, there was just a huge frustration that we're all encouraged to go Christmas shopping and blah, 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 but we're not allowed to do anything of such importance for the queer community. So it was really good that we did it anyway. The police were just in a car down the road. There was no trouble from them. So yeah, it was really, really magical. One of the significant things that came up again, which we already knew, but was really kind of the common theme on the night, was just that how much that day changed the world and the ripple effect of it, both for the community who were there, but the ripple effect from it, how it obviously led to pride. It led to the formation of GLF groups and similar groups in Paris and across mainland Europe. and who also then started their first prides. Just the kind of outburst of anger and solidarity on November the 27th, 1970, just how much it led to a life-changing moment for the people there and for the wider political situation. Yeah, it was such a magical night, as well as being fucking freezing. Yeah, it was really like deeply moving and so important to like commemorate it and do justice to what they started. And to obviously, you know, the what Louis Eakes went through, but doing justice to those everyone who was there and everyone who's kind of benefited from queer freedom and protest and solidarity since then.
What's next for the GLF?
I mean, there's so many things which we want to happen in terms of the 50th anniversary of the Revolutionary People's Convention, which was intended to be at the Bishopsgate Institute, which has the Gay Liberation Front archive, where we have speakers from women's liberation movements, old and new, Black Power movements, and other movements who are organising in the spirit of All Injustices Are Connected. That's supposed to be in May at Bishopsgate Institute. It might have to be online. Obviously, the Gay Liberation Front is an internationalist movement, both in principle and in action. And one of the movements we're part of is the growing international movement to confront the LGBT free zones in ideology and impact in Poland. That's supposed to be at the end of March. One thing which got sidelined last year, which I really want to happen this summer, is what we're calling the Bang Boat, which is a boat party down the Thames with the Gay Liberation Front to celebrate their 50 years of being absolute prolific legends in starting Pride and inspiring us all.
And finally, why do you think what you do and work towards is so important?
The job's not done of the GLF in terms of absolute freedom for all. And of course, I'm not believing that we're going to see that in my lifetime, but it's an honour to continue in the footsteps of what they started, because, you know, I'm a big believer in intersectionality, in that we're all interdependent human beings. If you're looking at the structures of domination and oppression in terms of the dominator society, it is always oppressed communities, queer, Black, women, trans, disabled, etc., who are always on the firing line. And so not really that much has changed if you're looking at what's going on in America with more shootings, with the rise of LGBT homelessness here, with xenophobia left, right and centre, with the rise of the far right all over the world, with coronavirus bill and the suppression of ability to protest. That's why it's important, because the oppressed and the oppressor live completely in different planets.
I mean, that guy just exudes so much energy and excitement.
And it makes me just gutted that we couldn't go.
Yeah.
And I really wish things were different.
I know. But if they were, then maybe we wouldn't have done this. So
very true. Oh my God, Fraser, you're so smart.
I know. Some people call me the Oracle. Some people don't.
I mean, I was just going to call you a wee smarty. Only smarties have the answer, babes. Now, as we said, Dan's book, United Queerdom, is available to buy now from Gays the Word and all other wonderful queer bookshops, which are available to you in the United Kingdom, but not in the European Union because we are no longer a part of it.
We are going to do one of Dan's tours that he organises when things open up.
Yeah, I think we should do that, and we should record it. And then people can like listen to us listening to him, reacting to him, and listen to us reacting to him.
I think the listeners are going to be crying out for that.
Yeah, I'm sure there's a change.org petition for that to happen as we speak.
Yeah.
But in other news, how's the dog, Fraser?
Oh, he's good. He's getting bigger by the hour. Bigger by the hour.
That's good. My sister got a dog and it's cute. It's a wee greyhound cross, but I don't know what the cross is with, but he's got lots of legs.
Well, can't beat a nice set of legs.
Very true, even on a dog. Now, Dan mentioned that at the march, Danny Singer also spoke.
That is an amazing name, firstly. And we thought, since we've spoken to Dan Glass, then maybe we should speak to Danny as well.
So we did. Can you tell us about your journey into queer activism?
I'm a trained community theatre practitioner, and I generally work either with the queer community or with older people with dementia, sometimes both, although not having done that, of course, for the past year or so. And then I also, with Dan, work with Queer Tours of London, so I'm a queer history tour guide as well, which I absolutely love. I've been involved in queer activism for about 5.5 years. I got involved in ACT UP London in October 2015, which was quite a watershed moment in my life, because at that point I still thought I was a straight cis woman, and then I just like found myself like, it was very funny actually. I went to this ACT UP meeting at Positively UK on the City Road. I found myself walking down the City Road really thinking, why am I going to this meeting? What force is like drawing me here? But it did feel very much like magnetism. It was very bizarre. Anyway, I was at this meeting, Dan Glass was there. That was mid-October. By the 1st of December, which of course is World AIDS Day, I was hosting HIV Blind Date at the Glory, which is a queer pub in East London. And I had very much done a full identity 360 by then. And I basically haven't looked back since. So I've been doing stuff with ACT UP on and off since then. I've also still stayed very much within sexual health, and I do a lot of work with Prepster. They are like the main sort of grassroots advocacy and sort of education and information group around PrEP and general sexual health. Do a lot of stuff with them around trans awareness and trans advocacy. I've also done various things around migrant rights, trans rights. So yeah, like fingers in quite a lot of pies.
How did you get into the Reformed Gay Liberation Front?
Absolutely just fell into it. Yeah, there was no way that I was not going to be involved, basically. But when the GLF was revived, I mean, I already knew half the people who were going, and I knew Andrew and Stuart. So I just went along to the first meeting just because I'm a bit of a meeting junkie and I couldn't say no. And it was really special, actually. I mean, like, nobody really knew what it was going to be, this revival. And like for the first few meetings, there was a sense of it, for me anyway, just being like a sharing space, which I thought was so valuable, because there was a lot of stuff, like talk about doing stuff around like reclaiming pride and like doing all these big campaigns, and it was just coming up for the anniversary of Stonewall and so on, and there was a lot of talk of activity around that, but that really played sort of second banana to, yeah, the space for these older activists to share about their lives and their experiences. And it was really powerful and really touching. And like, I mean, the GLF campaign has, like, it's not been like a regular campaign of like, this is our action, this is our demo, this is what we're doing. And then for me, it's felt like the creation of a living archive, which has been interspersed with events like Trafalgar Square recreation, which was 2019, and then Pride this year, and then like lots of other sort of events. But yeah, it's just felt like we've been creating this living, breathing, like moving archive, and it's been really powerful. But yeah, there was absolutely no way that I was going to miss out on it, and I feel really thrilled that I've been able to take part in it. Absolutely.
What part did you play in the 50th anniversary march, and how did it go?
So I was not the most available for all of the like nuts and bolts organization at the time. So that would have been throughout sort of October, November. I really wasn't involved in that at all. But Dan and Andrew and a few other people asked me if I might like to like host it, to MC it. But then in the run up to the original date, with it being locked down, and there was a lot of hassle with the police threatening to make arrests and slap £10,000 fines on people and so on. So essentially it felt a little bit like me and Dan became like kind of like coordinators of decision making. And then we made the decision to delay it for a week, and we still had the police like liaising with us. And in the end, I phoned up Islington Town Hall like on a number of occasions to try and get any clarity on what we could do, where the legal, like what was legal, what wasn't. And actually nobody answered the phone. The people who did answer the phone had no idea what I was on about. They had no idea about any, it was all very confused, and actually I felt very anxious about it, because I didn't want any trouble with the police, especially on this event, which was a commemoration of police brutality. The last thing I wanted was police brutality to happen. So I felt really anxious about the whole thing, actually, but still very adamant that it absolutely had to go ahead. Dan and I had a number of conversations about whether it was safe, whether the event was putting people at risk unnecessarily. And we just felt that, yeah, the history and the marking of such a significant milestone, like we couldn't miss it. So in the end, I spent a number of hours making a a very thorough risk assessment, which we printed off. And I, like, as a host for the event, I was very like drumming down social distancing, and I got all the PPE equipment that you could possibly want. And then in the end, the police didn't even show up, which I thought was very rude. And I was sort of making all the jokes to people about like, they were angling for an invite so hard, and then they didn't even show up. But obviously we were very, very pleased they didn't show up. So yeah, I was just able to host it. I had a really great time hosting it. you know, we'd also made the decision to scale it back a bit from the original plan, which had involved like the sound systems and like fireworks, blah, blah, blah. And we thought, no, actually, let's keep it intimate and keep it cozy, which also felt like a really good decision. For me, it really reduced the threat level because I was aware that I was sort of, as the host, I was a bit of a focal point. I'd had a lot of anxiety about that in terms of the police and so on. Once we'd relaxed into it, gosh, it just felt really magical, really evocative. A lot of the people who were there at the original said that it brought back so much of that atmosphere of that original demo of people just showing up, knowing that they kind of shouldn't be there, but doing their best to stay safe under those circumstances and just honouring each other and people speaking who we'd never even met before. A number of the speakers on the night were completely not planned. They'd either just turned up and asked if they could speak, or like we just sort of said, like, do you want to speak? Here you go. And people just stood up on a bench and they just spoke. They didn't have microphones. And it was just felt really gorgeous, actually. For me, it was an event of a lot of different emotions, ranging from like high anxiety through to absolute magic.
What's next on the horizon for the GLF?
I mean, it's really difficult to know. I feel like there's a lot of fire and there's a lot of passion and then there's a lot of anger about a lot of different things. But from my experience of the GLF, we've dabbled in like issues around queer homelessness. We've done like the No Pride in War stuff, which was about sponsorship and like involvement of arms dealers in like sponsoring or like having any involvement in queer or in pride, but also in wider queer life. We're doing tours with queer tours a lot. Like I'm just excited about all of it, really. I suppose having just said all that, the thing I'm most excited about is the surprise of it and actually seeing where it's going to go next that I can't even begin to predict right now. I'm excited and I'm willing to be surprised.
So that's us for episode 5. But in episode 6, we've got an update on John Breslin.
Now, do you think everyone remembers about John Breslin?
I mean, how could they not?
Well, you were very confused about John Breslin.
It really doesn't take much, TBH.
Well, as we discovered last year, John Breslin has family who are still alive.
That's right.
And since the last time we spoke to you, this happened.
Have you seen the email?
No, I couldn't get it on my phone.
Oh, God, you dick. John Breslin's cousin's got back to us, and he's happy to talk about John.
Oh, that's awesome. That's great.
Yeah. But from what I can gather, I think he's as in the dark about what happened to him as we are.
So next episode, we'll be bringing to you the very moving interview with John's family.
And we'll also be chatting to Lewis Hetherington, a playwright based in Scotland, who is creative lead for the Coming Back Out Ball, an LGBTI+ elder social dance club, a co-production between the National Theatre of Scotland and All the Queen's Men.
And Lewis invited one of the elders, David Allen, along to chat as well.
So make sure you hit subscribe to catch it.
But for now, we're off. See you next time on the 150 Marchers.
The 150 Marchers was written by Fraser Flintham and JD Stewart and edited by Fraser Flintham. Special shout out to Debbie Perry, Michael Dillon and Flynn McManus for providing additional voices for this episode.
Do you know anyone who attended the march? Anything that we've talked about that raises any kind of exciting flags for you, please get in touch with us.
You can find us on Twitter at 150 Marchers. Our DMs are open, so please slide on in.